Turning to our subject today, the subject we have set is perspectives on the current situation on the Korean Peninsula. And we have three eminent speakers. I will introduce them now and then call them to speak. The first is His Excellency Hyung Hak Bong, who is the Ambassador of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea in London. And obviously he will be able to give us a first-hand account of what is happening from his perspective on the peninsula. He studied at Gyeonggi University and Pyongyang University of Foreign Studies, and he was also Second Secretary of the Permanent Commission to the United Nations between 1996 and 1999. He's been the ambassador here since 2012, so we're very lucky to have him here with us today. The second speaker is Aidan Foster Carter, who is Honorary Senior Research Fellow in Sociology and Modern Korea at Leeds University. He taught sociology at the Universities of Bonn, Dar es Salaam and Leeds from 1971 to 1997. He's followed Korean affairs for 47 years, and since 1997 he's been a full-time career analyst and consultant, writing and lecturing and broadcasting on this subject. So again, we're lucky to have somebody with a great deal of experience. And our final speaker is Charles Scanlon, who worked for the BBC for 26 years as a reporter and editor, specialising in coverage of East Asia and Latin America. He covered the Korean Peninsula as a correspondent in the mid-1990s and again from 2000 to 2007, when he was based in Tokyo and Seoul. He obviously again will be able to give us an interesting perspective from a journalistic point of view. But without more ado, I'm going to call on our speakers in order. I will ask each of them to speak for about 10 minutes as usual, and then at about half past one, I will open it to questions and comments from the floor. And as usual, I will finish it dead on 2 o'clock, so that those who need to get away can get away without feeling embarrassed at having to walk out in the middle of a meeting. Anyway, without more ado, I will ask the ambassador to speak to us.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much, for inviting me to make a brief about the perspective on Korean situations in general. Well, as you are well aware, the Korean Peninsula is all the time focus of international community. There are many issues around the Korean Peninsula. It has been all the time tense. So I'd like to focus under the circumstances where the situation is all the time, volatile and critical, tense. What is the solution in the perspective of the, future, viewing by the deeper Korea? Well, June 15, after 1 week, we are celebrating the 15th anniversary of the adoption of the joint declaration by the two summits between the North and South, which was happened for the first time in the history of Korea. But if I speak a little more briefly, it has been 70 years in coming August 15, 70 years, since our people who used to live in one territory, sharing the same blood as one nation for 5,000 years long history, was divided into North and South by foreign forces. The history of the divided nation has witnessed the bloody war in 1950s, which was forced upon by foreign forces. For the Korean people, who have been living for a long time in agony of national division, there is nothing more desirous than national reunification. Not only all the Korean people in the North and South, but the conscientious people of the world aspiring after peace and security wish for the reunification of Korea at the earliest date and beginning of a new era of peace and prosperity in the Korean Peninsula and the Northeast Asia. Well, actually, you know, well, we have, you know, three programs, particularly, there are many programs, agreements reached between the North and South in the history, but there are three programs and, you know, agreements reached by the North and South, particularly by the summits of the North and South. You know, as I told you, the issue of Korea's reunification, born with the division of the country's territory, you know, as the Second World War ended, is, in a sense, the issue of safeguarding the sovereignty of the Korean nation and connecting its separated vein, that of realizing the national unity as one nation. The relationship between the North and South is a rather special one, temporarily formed among one nation in the process of moving towards its reunification, than the one between the two different countries. The modern human history and current reality of the world show that all states around the world have been formed and developed within a nation as a unit in most of the cases. Although there are many cases that various special groups within one nation state have different ideas, isms, doctrines, and it could even lead to confrontation, disputes, and civil wars between them, it can hardly go as far as breaking the state itself, while coexistence in the form of a federation or coalition within one state is becoming a general trend. The North and South Korea have gone along different paths of development, maintaining different ideas and political systems for a long time since the division of the country. Therefore, neither of them wants to abandon its respective ideology and system, albeit unification comes as their common aspiration. The North and South have developed the external relations with other countries in their own way, respectively according to each other's reality, and hence the geopolitical interests of the foreign countries in the Korean Peninsula have also developed in different ways. Under such special circumstances, it was required to find a way of reunification that is acceptable to both sides and without inflicting negative impact on the security concerns of the countries concerned. That is why our great leader, Comrade Kim Jong-il, established the three chapters of national reunification. The three chapters, which I said, three main things for national reunification, consist of three principles of national reunification and the 10-point program of great unity of the whole nation and the proposal of establishing the Democratic Federal Republic of Korea, put forward by our predecessor leader, great leader, President Kim Il-sung. The three chapters have reflected the actual conditions of the country and the nation's unanimous aspirations and demand for reunification, and comprehensively covered and systemized in an integral manner all the issues in realizing national reunification. For example, the charters have defined the fundamental principles, the dividing forces for national reunification, clarified the mode and method of reunification, and even gave a complete picture of the reunified state, including the ways of running the federal state and its administrative policy. It makes the three charters as a perfect charter for reunification in the true sense of the word. The fundamental principles of national reunification put forward by the three chapters are the ones of independence, peaceful reunification, and great national unity. These principles are the cornerstones of national reunification as they clarify the basic stand and method to solve the issue of reunification by the nation's own efforts according to the will and interest of the whole Korean nation in the North, South, as well as abroad, who are masters of the national reunification movement. The division of our nation is entirely attributable to the foreign forces, as I said, who will never grant us the reunification as they are using the division as a chance to fish in troubled waters. This is the truth fully proved by the history of tragic division that spans nearly 7 years. The 10-point program of the Great National Unity is a political program to strengthen the nation's own forces for reunification by achieving the unity of the whole nation in the North and South. The North and the South have been confronting for a long time with different ideas and systems, pointing guns at each other, and it deepened the mistrust between them and seriously hampered the improvement of North-South relations as well as the national unity. The North and the South should put an end, we believe, to the history of mistrust and confrontation and reconcile with each other. This is an important task in realizing the cause of national reunification. At the same time, it's the ultimate purpose and basic guarantee for its victory. The plan of establishing the Democratic Federal Republic of Korea is a design of the reunified state that presented the national mode of reunification by federal formula acceptable to both sides, North and South, and gave a complete picture of the reunified state, including the building, running of the state, of the international status. The proposal of a reunification by federal formula put forward by the three charters calls for the reunification of the country by founding a federal republic where the North and South exercised their own autonomous rights under the reunified national government, which is to be established on the basis of recognizing and accepting the existing ideas and systems of each other, confirming the fact that both sides belong to one nation as a common ground. More than one-third of the world population lives in a federal state of various forms. The possibility that two systems can coexist in a country and diverse political activities and different forms of ownership can coexist have already been proved by many international practices. The proposal for reunification in federal formula put forward by the three charters for national reunification clearly stated the official name of the state and the doctrine of the foreign policy as well as the administrative policy. Resuscitating the name of the first reunified state of nation, Goryeo, which known to the world is acceptable to both sides and also convenient in terms of national relations. The Democratic Federal Republic of Goryeo shall be a neutral state which does not take part in any sort of a political and military alliance or bloc, developing friendly relations with all the countries, especially the good neighborly relations with surrounding countries on the principle of independence, non-interference in internal affairs, equality, mutual benefit, and peaceful coexistence is the line of foreign policy. This is the most rational and peace-loving policy, reflecting the practical conditions in reunifying the North and the South with different ideas and systems. The general opinion of the academic circles of several countries is that the reunified state in federal formula for its independent, peaceful, and neutral nature and geopolitical location will not be a threat to any country, but a buffer zone that prevents conflict and disputes among the surrounding countries and become a bulwark of peace in the Northeast Asia. On the basis of a clear insight in the reality of the North and South, our General Kim Jong-il, who passed by, implemented an all-embracing policy of loving the country and the nation and the people to promote the coexistence and prosperity and common interest in disregard of differences in ideologies and systems and to cooperate with any person as long as they struggle for great cause of national reunification. Thanks to the tireless patriotic efforts of our leadership, two North and South summits were realized for the first time in the history of division, and the June 15 Joint Declaration and the October 4 Declaration, the program for the former's implementation were made public to the whole nation and the world. Thus, the position and charter of the three charters for national unification were formally promoted to the common national reunification program shared by the North and the South, rather than mere unilateral stand and assertion of the North. The three principles included in the three charters for national reunification, that is, independence, peaceful reunification, and great national unity, are the basis for national reunification and are the common reunification principles of the nation that were agreed between the North and South in 1972. And solemnly declared to the world, whole world as the July 4 joint statement. The North-South Joint Declaration, issued in the North-South Summit on the 15th of June 2000, opened a new era of national reunification movement by affirming the core of the three principles for national reunification, the spirit of national independence, the idea of by our nation itself, by achieving national consensus for the first time in history. In the June 15 Joint Declaration, the North and South recognized that the proposal by the North for low-stage federal formula and the one by the South confederal formula had points in common, and they agreed to navigate the moves for reunification in this direction. This is the first method for reunification common to the nation that was agreed between the North and South in the history of the national division. This historical agreement on building a unified state in confederal formula is a great and historic national asset. and the Joint Declaration on the Development of the North and South Relations was reinforced by the October 4, 2007. Again, that was agreed between the North and South at the summit level. And those practical program is to practice and implement the former one, the June 15 Joint Declaration agreed by North and South. I have many things, but because of time, I make it brief. But, you know, these days the June 15 Joint Declaration, as well as, agreements which were reached by the North and South, were refused by the South Korean regime. So, and also the confrontational policy and war atmosphere are still existing in the on the Korean Peninsula. So our position is that we should fulfill what had been already agreed between the North and South. Some people said that we should discuss again or something, but at the summit level already they agreed, and they were warmly welcomed by the European Union as well as the United Nations. From that, since the adoption of the June 15th Joint Declaration, the North-South relations began to develop. Peaceful atmosphere was created, including the Gaesong Industrial Complex, which now is operating in the Panmunjom area, is still working. This is the proof. And at the same time, Deep Air Korea was fully recognized by the many countries, including many Western European countries. United Kingdom is one of them. So at that time, the domestic and international atmosphere around the Korean Peninsula was developing in a very favorable way. But after, President Kim Dae-jung and Roh Moo-hyun passed, following rulers of South Korea, particularly then President Lee Myung-bak said that South Korea lost 10 years because of the joint declaration between the North and South, and he made it null and void. So he said that he regained the lost 10 years. So from that time on, the North-South relations began to be, you know, come down. And it is still, you know, a present ruler also follow that one. This is the perspective of the our government's view. So since we have a program, why not implement now? There are many ways and means to be implemented by the North and South in joint declaration and in declaration agreed between the summits. So why don't we implement now? This is the policy. So Marshal Kim Jong-un, the first chairman of the National Defense Commission of the DPR Korea, he said in his New Year address, North-South should refrain from seeking system confrontation while absolutizing their ideology and system. And he said that we should resolve, you know, we should try to resolve the unification question in the common interest of the nation, transcending the difference in ideology, you know, as they already agreed. So, you know, this is the policy. And I think your distinguished guests have many questions to make. For example, you know, one of the topic, nuclear or, you know, submarine or whatever you ask. But since the time, you know, I'm prepared to answer as far as I can. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm now going to call on Aidan Foster Carter to speak last 2 minutes.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very honoured to be here in this distinguished place. Do look up the history of the National Liberal Club and what H.G. Wells said about it. If you're probably all familiar, it's my first time here and I'm rather awed. I'm very grateful for the invitation and I apologise, I'm full of cold and cough. 10 minutes with the ambassador, what could one do? I am going to exercise heroic self-restraint, ambassador. It will not be me who asks you what is your favourite Eric Clapton track. It will not be me who asks you about whether Hyun Yong-chol is still the Minister of People's Armed Forces, though if you wish to comment on either of those, I would be eager to know. But you've focused on inter-Korean relations, so I'm going to scrap a bit of what I was going to say and try and do the same. I found almost nothing to disagree with in your words. It is a fact and has been a fact for a long time that the formal positions of the two Korean states on unification have been remarkably similar. The problem is getting from here to there. The problem is getting from the lived realities, which unfortunately are rather more sordid and difficult in a number of ways. Doesn't everyone mourn the tragic division of Korea, now 70 years old? I never thought it would last my lifetime, and seemingly not getting better, seemingly a permanent feature of the modern world. More recently, I too thought and hoped that the sunshine policy formerly pursued in South Korea marked a step change, had taken relations to the next level, and I regret that things have gone backwards since. Unlike the ambassador, though, unfortunately, I'm not able to put the blame entirely on the government of South Korea, although I do happen to think and have argued in innumerable boring publications that a number of errors were made, including not fulfilling the agreement of the second summit, which would have taken inter-Korean relations from the rather one-sided aspect of the giving of the first part of sunshine into a genuine win-win. That path wasn't taken. However, as the critics of sunshine always say, sunshine never addressed the military question on the peninsula. It was during that very period that your government tested its first nuclear device. And those arguments really do undercut those of us who would like to support sunshine. But let's go to exactly where we are now. I mean, your words were unexceptionable, Ambassador. Unfortunately, these are not the only words that issue from your republic. On the 4th of June, there was a statement from the strategic force of the Korean People's Army commenting on a South Korean missile test the previous day. Now, missile tests are not a rarity on the peninsula. I think it's fair to say that most of them come from the DPRK side. But on this particular occasion, South Korea tested its largest ballistic missile yet. It's certainly nothing comparable to the submarine-launched one, which you mentioned, your republic launched, which is a major technical breakthrough, a month earlier. But, so, the spokesman got extremely cross about this, not only about the launch of the missile, but also about the fact that President Park Geun-hye of South Korea had witnessed it. I was a bit puzzled by this, because given that you've got much bigger missiles and you boast of them, for the fact that South Korea should for the first time launch a missile of only 500 kilometres, which can, of course, hit the whole of the DPRK, doesn't seem such a big deal. But there were some very cross words, and I hate to quote them, but here we go. The Korean nation's history knows no such wicked woman as Park, who threw herself to do harm to compatriots with arms provided by outside forces, swishing her skirts to welcome them. The statement brands her as a military dog as she barks, as dictated by the US, and so on and so on and so on. Mr. Ambassador, this language does your state no credit, and you've used much worse of President Park in the past. I won't even quote it, file names and so on. Surely, a sort of basic principle, whatever substantive disagreements there are on many matters, is that this kind of language not be used. So it is not reciprocal. South Korea does not use whatever the equivalent terms might be about your leader, Kim Jong-un. So, and just one other thing on that aspect, the question of who these missiles are against. So it seems that the spokesman for the Strategic Force was cross because South Koreans should realise that this is not aimed at them. It's aimed at the Americans, so any Americans in the audience, you have been warned. But actually what it says, it's aimed at the US imperialist chief of aggression and a handful of traitors such as Park Geun-hye. So should I congratulate you, Ambassador, on these precision weapons which are going to be able to hit Chongwa-dae and eliminate President Park, but somehow not eliminate anyone else in South Korea? I hope you hear what I'm saying. This sort of language, both the substantive position, number one, and the language in which it is couched, number two, do not seem to me to be compatible with your hope for better ties. On a quite different level, I trust that the railway enthusiasts among you, and I'm sure there are some, will have noticed that North Korea recently stopped South Korea from being admitted to an organisation called the OSJD, or was it the OJSD? I always get that wrong. OSJD. This is the Eurasian Railway Organisation, and South Korea would like to join. President Park of South Korea is quite keen on trilateral cooperation and on rail links North-South Korea, Russia. And for some reason, your republic, because it has to be unanimity of the members, forbade this from happening. And again, I wonder why this was actually so. I wonder if you see any hope at all, Ambassador, for inter-Korean relations improving. There are some sports events coming up. You did send a team to the ASEAN and indeed a very high-level delegation last year. Sadly, nothing came of that. There are two similar events coming up this year. I'm conscious that we're short of time, and I want to try and close optimistically. This very day, some of you will be aware of a newspaper in South Korea called the Joongang Ilbo. I declare an interest. I write a column for it. That's quite a recent development. But this is probably the leading newspaper in South Korea, not just because they employ me, obviously, centre-right. And its chairman, an interesting man called Hong Suk-hyun, a former ambassador to the US of South Korea, is quite keen that policy change in South Korea. So he's set up a new, there's one article, you can find all this online, North in English, North Forum Calls for Bipartisan Policy. So here's a picture, he's gathered together the leader of the ruling party, the leader of the opposition, the Minister of Unification, all manner of bigwigs, trying to get South Korea to have what it has sorely lacked, a bipartisan policy towards the North which can break out of the present impasse and can somehow survive the changes of government which are a feature of democracy. And finally, in the same issue, there is a very plaintive article by a columnist of theirs. The Joongang has its own Unification Research Institute called When Will We Grow Tired of Fighting? And this brings together some of the things I've mentioned. It notes your missile launch, it notes the South's missile launch, and I hadn't made this connection. The South's missile launch was a day before the aforementioned railways meeting, which was in Mongolia. I may have failed to mention that's a very important point. And whether that meant that the North changed its mind and was cross because of the launch and so on. But anyway, the point that the columnist Ko Suk is making is, when will Korea get past that? And that seems a reasonable note. I hope it's not a rhetorical question. I hope it's a genuine question. I cannot believe that it is still all as bad in Korea as it is. And what is the task of great leadership? I think both Koreas have had some remarkable leaders and some not so good. Surely the task of leadership is not only continuity but change. We're in a new century now. It's intolerable that the division of Korea has persisted for 70 years. And to mention another anniversary, we're in the anniversary, not celebrating, of World War I. It's as if we are entrenched, aren't we, on the Korean Peninsula, each side and its allies. It's banging away from preconceived positions. I've probably been doing mine, you've been doing yours. Who will get us beyond this? We owe it to the future generations to get past this. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
I'm now going to ask Charles Scanlon to talk to us.
I think, like everyone here, I'm also very anxious to hear more from the ambassador so we can find out who's up and who's down in Pyongyang and all the latest information. So I'm going to keep a close watch on the clock. I first went to the Korean Peninsula as a correspondent 21 years ago. It was the spring of 1994. And the question that kept recurring to me during all the times I was covering on and off the Korean Peninsula was, why does North Korea always get the better of its diplomatic encounters with the United States? In 1994, the objectives of the North Korean government was to survive in a hostile world and to develop a nuclear arsenal that would ensure its security. Here we are, 21 years later, North Korea is still there, despite what a lot of people thought at the time. And it's not only tested nuclear weapons, but according to American military officials now, it's able to weaponize them to put them onto ICBMs. I turned up on the peninsula in the spring of 1994, and that was a very significant time, and I think that the events of that time actually do hold perhaps the key to what has happened with the diplomacy ever since. Shortly after I arrived, all the foreign press were called in by the American military to the sprawling U.S. military base at Yongsan. And the colonel said to us, this off-the-record briefing 20 years ago, but he said, we made a big mistake in the Gulf War, in Desert Storm. We kept the press too far away. This time, we're not going to do it. And he introduced us to the concept of embedding. And he said, if it comes to war on the peninsula and things are looking quite bad at the moment, we're going to have the foreign press embedded with US forces. So as soon as the fighting starts, we're going to bring in massive reinforcements. And I would like to see, he said, a CNN crew coming in with the Marine Expeditionary Force from Okinawa, who will be the first ashore. I'd like to see a New York Times man coming in with the 101st Airborne out of Kentucky, wherever it was, and perhaps a BBC crew could come in with the 1st Armored Division from Germany. This was the scale of it. And I put up my hand at that point and said, but what about us? What about the resident correspondents who are here in Seoul? Who will be looking after us? And he looked faintly apologetic and then said, oh, I'm sorry, you're dead. Because the assumption of the Americans at that time, they war-gamed it and looked at the implications of conflict, 5,000 North Korean shells landing every hour in central Seoul. He didn't think we had much chance of getting out, and we wouldn't be much use to the U.S. military. The conclusions we drew from that was, one, the Americans were seriously considering the logistics of fighting the war on the peninsula at that time, and two, they didn't think that they could hold Seoul, even though they were confident of winning the war. And I think it was that moment, and when the Pentagon looked very, very hard at the implications of the war, they came out with figures like a million dead in the first few weeks. Since then, it's been off the agenda. There's been no threat of American military engagement on the Korean Peninsula. I'm not saying the Americans were threatening a war. I'm saying that their diplomacy was geared up to risking a war. It was coercive diplomacy, and they were prepared to take it to the brink to get what they wanted. And you can make an argument that the joint agreement that was signed in 1994 as a result of that coercive diplomacy did in fact freeze North Korea's plutonium program for 8 years. Since then, it's been off the agenda, and in every single diplomatic encounter since then, the North Koreans, judged by their own objectives, have had the benefit of the doubt. The idea that the North Koreans, if they'd had the capability of testing a nuclear weapon in 1994 or even one of the big rockets, would have been inconceivable. I think that would not have been tolerated. There was a clear red line. I think the United States has consistently underestimated North Korean diplomacy in all those years, and they've also underestimated the resilience of the North Korean regime, because when I went to the peninsula in 1994, I assumed I was going to cover the unification of Korea. Germany had just gone, we'd had the fall of the Soviet Union, all the excitement in Eastern Europe. Everybody assumed that Korea was next, and that was also the assumption of the Americans. A lot of the negotiators didn't believe that the North Korean regime would be around to reap the benefits of the joint agreement. I think once again they underestimated the degree of state control and the extent to which this was just not another authoritarian regime. This was something of a completely different order, and I think they underestimated it. North Korea gets underestimated, South Korea gets underestimated in terms of its potential as an industrial power. It was written off in the 60s and 70s by Japan and everybody else. Look at it now. North Korea, I believe, is the same. I had a few more words to say, but I think I'll call it and hopefully we can get some questions in for the ambassador. Thank you.